This is KYUK, public radio for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. I'm Anna Rose MacArthur. Grant Aviation is suing the company that runs the air traffic control system at Bethel's airport, claiming that the company was responsible for a plane crash last year on the runway. This lawsuit was filed after a report came out last week showing that Alaska had twice as many aviation accidents as the rest of the country. KYUK's Christy Schallenberger has more.
Last July, a Grant Aviation plane crashed on the Bethel runway and burst into flames. Luckily, none of the five passengers or the pilot were seriously injured. It was a clear day with little to no wind, according to a preliminary report from the National Transportation Safety Board. The report says that the pilot, who was coming in from Neutok, asked to land on a certain runway because of how many planes were landing and was performing a go-around maneuver when the traffic controller interrupted him and urgently told him to, quote, turn left immediately. As the pilot obeyed, he says the plane suddenly stalled, rolled right, and then crashed. The report says the pilot saw the flames and evacuated the five passengers before the fire grew out of control. The NTSB is still investigating. Fast forward 6 months later, Grant Aviation filed a suit against Serco Incorporated, a Virginia-based company that operates the air traffic controller positions in Bethel. The complaint says Serco failed to properly train its employees to manage the amount of airplane traffic that was coming in. Specifically, the complaint points to the air traffic controller's abrupt command as proof of that negligence. Anchorage law firm Richmond & Quinn is representing Grant and did not return emails or phone calls for the story. Serco declined to comment. Meanwhile, something hit the prop of another Grant Aviation plane during takeoff in Hooper Bay on February 4th. 2 days later, a Ute commuter service plane crashed several miles from Tuntutuliak, killing everyone on board. The NTSB released a report last week revealing that Alaska has twice as many aviation accidents as the rest of the country and urged federal regulators to work with the state to improve safety. Reporting in Bethel, I'm Christy Schallenberger.
Starting in October, if you want to fly on a commercial flight anywhere in the United States, you will need a federally compliant Real ID, or an official alternative like a passport. Getting one of those IDs can be burdensome. It requires a lot of documentation, and lines at the DMV can last 3 hours or longer. And that's if your community has a DMV in the first place. As KOTZ's Wesley Early reports, lawmakers and state officials haven't figured out how to help rural Alaskans get their IDs.
Many, if not most, rural residents will need access to flights for medical appointments or emergencies at some point.
In case of life-threatening emergencies, patients are often medevaced to Anchorage or Seattle, and once they get better and are able to return home, they'll have to take a regular flight back home. So all these scenarios happen routinely and will require that patients have a compliant ID by October 1st under the current act.
That's Jacqueline Bergstrom, Executive Director of Medical Services for the Tanana Chiefs Conference. Bergstrom is concerned that if villagers can't get real IDs, they may get stranded after medical flights. State lawmakers in the House Tribal Affairs Committee heard testimony Thursday from Bergstrom and other rural Alaska leaders who were concerned about getting real IDs for their communities and want lawmakers to help. Melanie Banke is the CEO of Kowarik, a tribal consortium in the Bering Straits region.
I do think it's the legislature's job to appropriate funding to ensure that every village in the state of Alaska has somebody going to their community at least once and providing that as an opportunity versus a community of 800 people trying to fly into Nome to obtain their real ID.
Even if a village could organize flying everyone who wanted a real ID to the nearest hub DMV, it would be expensive. Round-trip tickets from surrounding villages to Kotzebue can cost as much as $600. Charlie Nelson is vice president and tribal affairs head for Manilik Health Consortium based in the Northwest Arctic Borough. He says Kotzebue's DMV hours are very limited since the one person who works there also works as an admin for the local police department. Oh, and also, it's closed on Wednesdays for road tests.
DMV office is only open for 4 hours a day. When that person is out sick or has other issues, personal and or business, it is usually closed, so we don't have any direct access to it on a full-time need.
The state has been trying to solve this problem for a while now without much success so far. Last year, it put out a pitch for Alaskans to donate to the State Department of Motor Vehicles to get workers out to rural communities, though they've since ditched that idea. Then, there's a state mobile DMV pilot program that's been going through villages to help get tribal members signed up, though it's not always on the state's dime. Now, the state has been pushing for residents to use alternatives to the Real ID when the deadline hits. Those include passports, military IDs, and federally recognized tribal IDs with photos. With the October deadline looming, Representative Tiffany Zolkowski of Bethel, who chairs the House Tribal Affairs Committee, told the DMV representative at the hearing that the department should be more proactive in explaining Real ID alternatives to tribes.
If it's being shared with a group of legislators, it seems like it could be shared as a letter to a Dear Tribal Leader letter, so people know what opportunities there are to meet other standards, specifically if the department is relying on tribal IDs as an alternative option, but something to consider moving forward.
One more wrinkle is that even with the tribal IDs, tribal officials are concerned that the local TSA officials have not all been trained properly on recognizing the various forms of acceptable IDs. Additionally, Banky with Kowarik says just because someone is an enrolled tribal member of a tribe, it doesn't mean they live there.
I don't want to be stranded somewhere and just thinking that the TSA officer is going to accept my native village of Savunga-issued tribal ID. I'm a state citizen, and I should have the access to state-issued real ID.
Including the alternatives, the state DMV estimates that about 6,700 rural Alaskans who don't have a DMV in their community still need help with getting an ID. Calls made to the state DMV office concerning state outreach went unanswered as of this report. Reporting in Kotzebue, I'm Wesley Early.
This summer, the Pacific Ocean was hit with the second marine heat wave of the decade. Mirroring the first so-called blob of 2014, scientists measured ocean temperatures more than 5 degrees above normal across millions of square miles stretching from Alaska to California. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Kavitha George reports that for now, it looks like it's subsiding.
The first blob decimated fisheries, caused a massive seabird die-off, and spurred toxic algal blooms up and down the coast. In the last year and a half, a second heat wave began brewing. But then it disappeared, at least for now. NOAA research scientist Nate Mantua says they're seeing surface ocean temperatures drop back to the 30-year average before the first blob.
Parts of the Bering Sea, the temperatures are a little below normal, which is nice to see for the first time for a few years. And most of the area around the Aleutians and the coastal waters in Alaska are back to about normal being the average from 1981 to 2010.
But that's not to say that the troubling long-term warming trend that comes with climate change has slowed. Mantua says we may see short-term warm and cold periods, but the warming trend will continue.
It could go either way in the next few months, in the next year, but the longer term, you know, next few decades, you'd expect that background warming is just going to continue to build up.
University of Washington oceanographer Nick Bond says it's important to note that the North Pacific never fully returned to normal temperatures after the first blob. The second blob just compounded the heat wave, warming waters at a greater depth and at higher temperatures than before. This winter brought cold northern winds and heavy storms to Alaska. Storms help to mix up ocean waters and release heat trapped below the surface. But Bond says deeper ocean layers are still hotter than normal.
This winter, there has been some cooling of those subsurface temperature anomalies, but they're still well above normal. And I think for some of us, there's just some concern that even if these storms keep up, they won't remove all that extra heat at depth.
Chris Holderide is a NOAA scientist who studies algal blooms in Kachemak Bay. She says it's hard to tease out what the effects of this most recent heat wave are and what's just a hangover from the first blob. It's not always easy to predict where toxic algal blooms will pop up, but recent rising ocean temperatures brought them to many parts of coastal Alaska, she says.
There were some areas that actually had fairly high blooms and more paralytic shellfish poisoning, and then some that didn't. And what we're finding up in the Bering and Chukchi seas in the Arctic is that there's some very high levels of these cells that cause paralytic shellfish poisoning. And that, with the really warm temperatures that they had up there, is a big concern.
But with these somewhat colder waters, Holderide is hopeful that coastal ecosystems might start to bounce back.
We're going into this spring and summer with the waters actually getting cooled off a bit. And you can imagine that the near coastal waters, right, the shallower waters, can cool off faster because they're not as deep, right? There's not as much water to cool off. And so we're hopeful that for the near coastal ecosystems, that'll be an advantage. But it remains to be seen.
Monitoring over the next few months and fishery surveys this year will help give a clearer picture of the ecosystem impacts of the second blob. But right now, scientists say it's just too soon to know for certain. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Kavitha George.
This is KYUK News. I'm Anna Rose MacArthur. Thanks for listening. Please email your comments and news tips to news@kyuk.org. And stay tuned for News Yukdun coming up.